Session number 14837, Reel 1.
James, Reel 1, where were you born?
I was born in Southfields, which is next door to Wimbledon in South London, in 1923.
What did your father do for a living?
He was, funnily enough, in the domestic appliance business. He was in gas and electrical retailing.
Did you go to school at Southfields?
Only for a short time, because he died when I was 9 years of age, and I moved up to North London, where I was lucky enough to get a scholarship to Latimer, a splendid school in Edmonton.
Were you still at school when war broke out?
Oh no, I left school in May 1939, and that really is where my wartime experience started, however, because I joined Middlesex County Council and they put me into the embryo air raid precautions department, which consisted of a Major Weber, a Captain Matheson, a clerk, Harry Axtell, Doris the typist, and me, the general dog's body. And we started to get air raid precautions organized, and before we knew where we were, war was on the horizon. And we moved to Hendon Technical Institute to set up Group 6 London Civil Defence Region. And although I was only 16, I knew more about air raid precautions than most people. And so I had an interesting year or two until I was 18. And being responsible for the message room was a lot of young women and the dispatch riders. This was all for 30 bob a week.
What was the message room?
Well, the message room was there to get incidents reported from the various posts around the region, and we then sent out the necessary fire engines or whatever from there. It was a sort of operations room. They sent me to the Civil Defence College at Fowfield, I remember, to become an instructor in anti-gas operations. And that was rather fortunate, because I was able to supplement my salary by doing lectures. All very extraordinary. A boy of 16 or 17, I find. I didn't think it at all strange at the time. But, of course, I wanted to get into the war, and as soon as it was possible, I volunteered for the Royal Air Force.
Can you tell me what kind of air raid precautions Middlesex County Council had introduced?
Well, that was, of course, there were the fire and rescue services, and they set up depots all around the area, and of course there were the air raid wardens, all that sort of thing that happened all over the country, of course. Nothing unusual about them.
Was it a very impressive organisation?
Well, in retrospect, I think it was quite extraordinary, because people, I suppose, very much were feeling that they could contribute to the war effort. As you know, we started to get bombing, of course. Everybody got a lot more experience, but well, it's a long time ago now, and it's a job really to remember too much about it. But I mean, there was the fabulous Anderson shelters that everybody had, that I expect most people have heard of, which were constructed of corrugated sheet steel and half buried in the ground. Never had any experience of how effective they were, but it certainly was a very good idea, and people felt safe, so that's for sure. apart from my dear mother, who saw a beetle in hers and said, "That's that, I'm not going in there again," and spent the rest of the war ducking under the dining room table.
Did many bombs fall in your immediate area where you live in?
Oh, yes. In fact, the very first, I believe the first bomb of the war fell on the Alcazar Cinema in Edmonton. But nobody was hurt. But of course, we had that period of the phony war when not very much happened.
Did any houses get destroyed in your own streets?
No. We were quite lucky, really. And I think, the part of the world where I was living then, it was quite lucky, really.
What was your address in Edmonton?
It was Hydethorpe Avenue.
Now, I think you were just about to tell me how you came to be in the forces.
Yes. Well, because I desperately wanted to get in the forces. Most young men of my age did. And I really did want to fly. And I knew a lot about aeroplanes. And I went to the recruiting station at Burnt Oak Broadway. And they thought I'd be a suitable candidate. And I had a brief medical and said, "Right, when do I go?" And I said, "Oh, it'll be about 6 months." Well, this wasn't good enough for me, so I went next door to the naval recruiting office, and there was an old chief petty officer there, and I said, "How soon can you get me in the Navy?" And he eyed me up and down and said, "Well, what do you want to be, son?" I said, "Well, I don't know. What have you got?" He said, "I think you'd make a very good seaman." And my chest swelled, and I said, "Gosh, really? How long before you can get me in?" And he said, "Well, for you, son, you're so keen, I think I can get you in about 10 days. And bless my soul, in 10 days' time, I was down at HMS Collingwood in Fareham. And that's how I came to join the Navy, more by accident than anything else. And, of course, apart from the fact of the war, it's something I've never regretted. I think I was very fortunate to have been able to join the RN. And, of course, if I had joined the Air Force, I probably wouldn't be here today because of the enormous casualty rate that there was.
What kind of training did you have at Collingwood?
Oh, we had 6 weeks' training. We had square bashing, of course, knots, ropes, splices, all the basics that you find in an Admiralty seamanship manual. And again, I think a lot of the training that one had there has been very useful to one in later life. I certainly look back on that time with quite a lot of pleasure. I quite enjoyed it, really. Except for the language, which was quite new to me.
You mean the terms or the swearing?
The swearing, which was even worse when I actually went to sea, of course. But there we are. Anyway, I came out of there as an ordinary seaman and went up to Scapa. And I remember I went on the Iron Duke, which they'd actually, I think, cemented the sea bottom, and it was used as a transit ship. And one of the jobs I had was painting the yard of the Iron Duke, which was, I don't know, 100 feet in the air. And I had to crawl along this thing. I was absolutely terrified. But I did it, and I was then sent to Flotta, which is a little island up there, also in transit, and they asked if anybody could cook. And I thought very quickly about what that meant. And I said, "Yes, I can cook," because it did mean that I'd be warm. And the one memory of that is rice pudding for about 60 airy matlows that I shortly got a ship which was a Hunt-class destroyer.
I think this was HMS Middleton. Can you tell me what impression the ship made on you on joining it?
Well, of course, to me, Middleton, she looked to the untutored eye a sleek and, of course, quite new destroyer. And in fact, of course, it was very much a utility ship of the Navy, and many were produced during the war. They weren't very fast. I think if we managed 28 knots absolutely flat out, that would be about it. And they were primarily there as escort vessels, anti-submarine work and anti-aircraft work. The facilities were minimal, I remember. I think really, on the lower deck, the conditions were fairly appalling. There was no heating, and of course we were going to go up north. No heating. Our clothing was quite inadequate for what we were going to do, and the food was terrible. The things I remember most now are spending weeks in clothes. We had sheepskins, and we had rubber boots and leather sea boots. Well, the leather sea boots were no good in bad weather because you skidded all over the place. The rubber sea boots were because you had frozen feet. And I also remember that because we didn't have enough clothing, we had to share the sheepskins from watch to watch. And we then got the most terrible epidemic of scabies on board, which the doctor put down to the interchange of these sheepskin garments. Anyway, we went mostly at that time on Russian convoy, which really was, to me, a mixture of awfulness, because it was a time of PQ-17, which we covered, and to see merchant navy ships just blow up and know there was very little that you could do for them was an appalling sight. Well, that was the awful side of it, but that part of the world is, in the summer, is very beautiful, and it's clear, and amazingly, you do keep quite healthy because the atmosphere is so clean.
Were the merchantmen going down to U-boats or aircraft?
Oh, U-boats. As far as I was concerned, because some other places they were going down with aircraft, but very often we operated too far away for aircraft to touch us.
Was HMS Middleton involved in that notorious scatter order that was given on PQ-17?
Yes, well, we were in the cover. We were part of the covering force, so we didn't actually do it. But yes, that's right. And of course, that was the whole object of a convoy is to protect. Directly, you scatter, ships can be picked off one by one. I think we, of course, we went to Murmansk and to Archangel, and. Like I say, one of the people that have seen me and Mainland and Bear Island. But we took supplies to Murmansk and had the misery of seeing them bombed after we'd gone to all the trouble to bring them from the UK, which pretty awful.
Did you go ashore in Russia?
Oh, yes, we went ashore in Russia, in Archangel. Because the funny thing was, just harking back a bit, that before we left the UK, we had mosquito nets and quinine and all sorts of tropical things were put on board, and we rubbed our hands and thought we were going to go down south. What we didn't realise is that Archangel and the surrounding area was a malarial region, because it's full of swamps, because I expect it's all been cleared up now. But it was a great disappointment to us to find ourselves going north and not south.
So you slept on a mosquito net?
No, we didn't. It was one of those things that one found during the war, that all sorts of things were issued that were fairly useless. You try and put a mosquito net over a hammock, I think.
What did you see ashore in Russia?
Well, very little, really. I think the thing I remember about Archangel at the time was the fact that everything was wood. Again, I understand it's quite different now, it's quite a city. But the reason for that was that it could survive the winter, whereas if you had concrete, it used to crack up. So we were told at the time, I don't know. But I suppose the sight of women doing heavy manual labour, never seemed to see any men doing any heavy manual labour. The sight of a pretty young girl who, when she opened her mouth, got a mouthful of stainless steel teeth, was rather off-putting to all of us, and I think so. The sight of Russian soldiers paralytic with vodka on vodka issue day, I remember. And of course, one of the things that we found was that we were escorting these convoys over, but the Russians didn't do very much to help us. They came out on the last, I don't know, perhaps 50 miles or so to escort us in, but we got no help from the Russian Navy at all.
Did the Russians seem at all grateful?
Not really. We didn't have very much contact with them. I think they were rather impressed when we carried out divisions on the quayside there. I don't think they'd ever seen anything like that.
What did that consist of?
Well, we just marched up and down and had a church parade on the quayside, which I think our skipper thought would impress them. The other thing, I remember going back to the duties on board, I was allocated captain's messenger, which meant in action stations I stood by the captain. But I also had the job of being the aircraft spotter, because knowing a lot about aeroplanes and that I did when I was a youngster. There I was at the age of 18, the job of saying, "It's all right, sir, it's one of ours." luckily, I seemed to get it right. But, when I was out there, it was suggested that I might like to apply for a commission, and I thought, well, anything's better than this, I think. And so I did, and I did my preliminary interviews in Russia on board with, I seem to remember a couple of officers from other ships, and I seem to get through all right, but one of the things I particularly remember is they asked me to do knots and splices for some extraordinary reason. Knots and splices using Costin gunline. Well, if you know what Costin gunline's like, it's very thin line that you use when you're firing a rocket from a Costin gun from one ship to another. And in the bitterly cold weather, I can remember frantically trying to do this sort of thing, which, of course, had got nothing to do at all with whether I was suitable to become an officer or not. Anyway, we go, I suppose, the end of 42, we were due for a refit in Hull, and I, of course, left the ship and went to King Alfred at Brighton, where we had taken over, or the Navy had taken over, what was a sort of leisure complex at Brighton, and we slept in the underground garage, I think under what is now a swimming pool. I may be wrong about that. And for the second part of the course, we went to Lancing College, which was very much better. And it was, a mishmash of everything you can imagine, I suppose, really. They're trying to turn us into officers in 3 months. Navigating courses, all sorts of things. Whether it made us fully equipped, I don't know, but the exigencies of the war meant that we had to be turned out very quickly.
Did it get attacked by the German Air Force whilst you were there?
No, not at all. I think the worst thing that happened while we were there, of all things, we had to mount guard at Lancing College with fixed bayonets at night, and one very zealous officer pounced upon a sentry who he thought was not being too awake, and as a consequence got a bayonet in his arm as a result. That caused a lot of amusement, I can tell you. But I passed out from there as a midshipman, of course, and volunteered for Coastal Forces because I thought there was a chance I might be able to get my own command if I did, and I was accepted and went to Fort William for training. Well, we were put up in a hotel at Fort William looking down on the lock, and I remember my first sight was I think it was an ML catching fire and blowing up first thing in the morning. I can't remember the details or the circumstances of it, but it was a salutary lesson that I never forgot, of the dangers of having large quantities of aviation fuel on board ship. That I had to go and have my first interview with the commander of the base, and he sat me down and he said, "Well, now, James, tell me, have you got a split-second brain?" And I said, well, sir. And he said, "Obviously you haven't," and roared his head off with laughing. Apparently he did this to every poor young unfortunate. But it was, of course, quite a new world to me, because it was so different from a destroyer. In these coastal force vessels, they're quite small, and you had the chance actually to handle them yourself, and a lot of it, of course, was navigation in a blacked out wheelhouse, and you roared around the lock, and I remember the engines dying down and a voice saying, "Come up top, Snotty," and I went up top, and there we were within yards of the shore, and he said, "I thought I'd better stop engines, we were heading straight for it." But we also got the experience of firing dummy torpedoes, I remember, and so on. So I did my course there, and I can't remember the actual dates, but I also did a 2 weeks course at Greenwich College, a navigation course too. But I can't remember that before or after Fort William. But I then got my marching orders and went down to HMS Beehive, which was Felixstowe, and joined the 21st MTB Flotilla under Peter Dickens, who was the great 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 grandson of Charles Dickens, and a splendid and very fine senior officer of that flotilla. My skipper was Tom Neal, and I met him again for the first time the year before last. Still a very lively character. And I served there as a spare officer and navigator for a few months. And I suppose the most heart-rending thing to me then was the fact that I was transferred as senior officer's boat one night to act as navigator, and the chap who replaced me on board, you remember his name, Richards, he went out and he got killed that night, and there but for the grace of God went I. And of course we had to meet his family, because nobody said that what had happened, that we'd switched.
What kind of operations were you on?
We were operating off the Dutch coast then, and we were obviously looking for convoys all the time. And it was a very active area at that time, and we went over, I suppose, every other night. We usually used to get a night off, but Saturday was always known as Bloody Saturday, because people always got hurt on Saturday nights, I remember. That was an extraordinary thing, the way these myths creep up. But yes, it was a lot of action. You know, a lot of famous names then, but people like Hitchens, who was a famous gunboat skipper, and you find his picture in the Naval Club in Hill Street, who was killed by a stray bullet miles away from any action, which was a terrible tragedy.
Do any specific operations stand out in your mind?
Not really, then, because you know, when you had the job as navigating officer, you were just in the wheelhouse all the time, and you were blacked out, and you were just sweating doing this. I mean, we've got to remember, at that time we had very little in the way of navigating equipment. You know, you were relying on a magnetic boat's compass. The radar that we had was radar that was really for spotting aircraft. It was useless for navigating. We did one or two mine laying trips, however, when we got Deccan navigation equipment put on board, I remember. And that, of course, was marvellous, because we really could fix our position. But the whole business revolved around being able to navigate very, very fast. You know, sometimes you head around rather quickly in quite strong tides, of course, off the Dutch coast. And, you know, that was my forte, that I was quite good at it.
Did any of the MTBs you were on get hit by?
Oh yes. Yes, we had quite a few hits. And I mean, at that time, what we're talking about, 43.
It was April to September, according to your sheet.
Yeah, that's right. There were quite a lot of casualties at that time. But we were fairly lucky.
What type of things would you be hit by?
Oh, very much 40mm and 20mm cannon shells. That was what, you know, really what you came up against, because they had a lot of armed trawlers, that sort of thing, in their convoys. Rather different from what one experienced out in the Med later. But, as I say, my time was mostly spent down below in the dark.
How successful do you think these operations were?
Well, it's a job for me to tell in retrospect. I say I was really at Felixstowe a relatively short time. But I guess they must have been fairly successful. But I think records would tell. I could tell you much more about the records in the Med, where I spent a lot more time, and I actually have got the records there. But I say it was a short period of time for me, really. And then, of course, I got sent out to the Med, and joined the 7th MTB flotilla, which had already had seen a lot of action, but had very old boats, and they were forever breaking down, and I think the really important time for the 7th flotilla